I'm Brian Kluger, and I am with the toga-wearing, werewolf-shooting, blues-singing descendant of Zamunda, my amigo himself, John Landis.
Did you practice that?
A little bit.
It's very impressive.
Very impressive. Very impressive. How are you doing today?
I'm swell, thank you.
You're doing well. I have some questions for you. You've been in the movie business quite a while. I guess one of my first questions is, working for a few decades, what do you think of the state of filmmaking now, and as opposed to cameras, like, you know, shooting on cell phones, as opposed to, you know, film stock and Super 8 and 16 millimeters today?
What do I think of it?
Yeah, what do you think?
Doesn't matter what I think of it. Film is essentially, except as a, what's the word? What's a good archival? For archival purposes. And, I mean, people still shoot on film. And even if you shoot on film, regardless, you finish digitally.
Right, right. You
know? So, what do I think of it? It certainly is getting better all the time. It's quite extraordinary now.
So do you think it improves, or do you think it dilutes?
I think it's an... I don't think either one, actually. The early days of digital, which is only 10 years ago... it looked like shit, but now you can do so much in post that there are many features shot in digital now that look great.
All right. So your first amazing film, Schlock, would you have shot it on digital if you had the option to?
Well, because it would have been cheaper, I would have. But no, I mean, I'm still pretty old school in terms of my knowledge. I know everything about film, so I know how to shoot movies digital, quite candidly. You know, it's amazing to me, with your iPhone, you go, there's no light in here, and you can still take a picture. You
know? Right, yeah.
So it's very different, and I don't know enough technically about it, so I just have to rely on crew. but it's fine. I mean, it's a recording device. It's just another recording device.
Okay, all right.
The only thing that's really changed is how you should refer to movies, is you should call them motion pictures.
Motion pictures.
That's because you call them films. The problem is now they're not.
So motion pictures, not pieces of cinema, just motion pictures.
They're cinema.
Okay, cinema. Right.
Absolutely cinema.
All right.
But they're not film. Film is not used that much anymore, even for still photography.
Okay, all right. So I want to go to one of your movies, Coming to America, and
that movie's 30 years old.
It is. It still holds up completely. And I've got to ask about the barbershop scene in working with Arsenio Hall and Eddie Murphy. How do you direct that scene? Do you just like turn on the camera, step aside, and say 2 hours go, or did you actually write and plan and direct that? How set me up that scene?
Well, first of all, once we decided that Eddie and Arsenio would play multiple characters, I didn't want to use any optical, so no matting or composition or superimposing. So I just shot it straight, which meant, for instance, over the shoulders, where if it's over the shoulder of Akeem onto the barber, mm-hmm. both are Eddie. So we used Charlie Murphy, who was a very good double for Eddie. And so half that scene, who you think you're seeing, is not. also, when Eddie plays the old Jewish guy, Saul, sitting in the, you know, reading the raising form over there, Rick Baker, who made the extraordinary makeup, he based the design of Saul on his father-in-law. Mr. Abascal, who is Sicilian or Italian. He's not Jewish, but, you know, all those Mediterranean guys look the same. So that's why you always have Jews playing Italians and Italians playing Jews, you know. So
right here.
Well, it's true.
Yeah.
You know. What was I saying? It's just that there's – so because he based it on his father-in-law, Mr. Abascal, uh-huh. And my wife, Deborah, made a brilliant costume for him with a hump built into him and just really good. I could isolate him there, and I could isolate. You had to figure out your coverage because Saul is here and Clint is there and Arsenio's there and Eddie's there. And they're all talking to one another. So once I figure out all my sight lines and we set up and shoot, they're all acting basically to me.
Okay.
I'm off camera doing all the, for Eddie, I'm everybody. And then I cut it together and it plays fluid because it's, that's how film works. And we did improv a little, but no, that most of that's written.
Most of that was written.
Yeah. There's a wonderful, that thing that when Eddie is the old barber goes off on that story about meeting Dr. Martin Luther.
Which is great.
Yeah, that was an improv.
That was improv.
Yeah, when he says, oh, excuse me, I thought you were someone else. And also Clint's line was, you never met Martin Luther King. And he said, you never met no Dr. Martin Luther the King. You know, so we did have... and then I had Eddie as the Jewish guy. I gave him a bunch of lines, and we did certain things, and got all that stuff. And then I just had him make expressions and react to certain things. My favorite thing is I said, okay, I want you to tell a joke. What joke? So I just told him a joke, and I said, okay, now you tell it as Saul. So he tells that joke that I end a movie with.
Aha!
Which is a great joke.
Did he add that, or did you add that? Aha!
That's the joke.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's the punchline of... That's an old Jewish joke.
It is so good. Well, thank you for that. Yeah, I've always wanted that. This is one of my favorite scenes, so I've always...
Well, it's in the end credits, you know.
The whole thing is great. Moving on, you've also worked with Michael Jackson. You did Thriller and Black or White. I was curious on Thriller, working with such a creative talent as Michael and as yourself, did y'all just mesh together and become the creative duo force right away? Or
I don't know what that... You've got to understand, when you work with certain stars, they get credits for things they didn't do.
Okay.
And Michael was a brilliant performer.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't write it, but he gets a writing credit. Mm-hmm. And he didn't produce it, but he gets a producing credit.
Okay.
And he didn't really choreograph it. Michael Peters choreographed
right.
it. But he gets a choreograph. But, you know, that one I would say is fair. But okay. It's his production company. But Michael basically, he was a big fan of An American Werewolf in London.
Mm-hmm.
And he was particularly taken with the Metamorphosis. The Rick Baker...
Because American Werewolf was like one of the first times you saw the actual transformation on screen, right?
I guess. It was done in real time, and he was naked, and you know, there were no cutaways. And there's one cutaway to Mickey Mouse, but other than that, there's no opticals in it. And anyway, he was very taken with it, and he wanted to turn into a monster. That was his, I want to turn into a monster. So what kind of monster? And so I had Rick Baker come over, and we talked, and we ended up with the werecat thing, which is kind of based on the teenage werewolf, you know. It's why it's set in the 50s.
Right,
the,
yes.
The movie they're watching. And then zombies. We still ended up dancing. I think Michael wanted... Rick Baker thinks he wanted zombies, but I think it was Michael. But in any case, so it was zombies and a werecat monster. And it doesn't really make sense. It's just a dance video, you know.
But it makes perfect sense on how they're going through and just the whole thing. I thought it was still one of the best videos, if not the best video of all time.
I don't. Who knows? You know, there are lots of really good videos. But what was wonderful is it captures Michael in his prime. So
right. Exactly.
That's pretty exciting. He was an absolutely extraordinarily gifted and brilliant performer.
Right.
Incredible. Did you ever see him live?
So I was actually slated to, I actually had tickets to night 4 at the O2 Arena before he...
So the answer is no.
The answer is no. Yeah. So no. Unfortunately, did you ever get to see him live at a concert?
40 or 50 times. But the thing about Michael is as a live performer, he was literally explosive. I mean, in real life, you could put your arm through him. I mean, he had no presence in a room. But as soon as he turned it on, he was... powerful. And like people who saw him at Wembley or Madison Square Garden or Dodger Stadium or wherever, if you know someone who went to the concert, they'll tell you that, you know, he might have been this big, mm-hmm. But he was still just power. I mean, incredible. He's a skinny little guy. You know, he's a small guy. He's the same size as Fred Astaire. And but he just was a genuinely extraordinary performer.
And yes, he was. And he was known as kind of like a prankster on set, doing some fun pranks. Did you hear?
Well, Michael, you know, he had no childhood. Yeah. You know, the Jackson 5 were doing four shows or six shows a day in lounges in Vegas, and four shows a day at the Apollo. I mean, he was working since he was eight and hard. And he was an abused child. His father is a pig, you can quote me. I really liked Mike. He was a good, I enjoyed him. And if you look at what's so interesting about the making of Thriller.
And which is still great.
Well, it's unusual in that it's completely accurate. Mm-hmm. There you go. And he was great, full of energy and wonderful, hardworking. He was great. I mean, he was silly sometimes, but so am I. So, you know, I really enjoyed making that.
Oh, good. Yeah, me too. I'm glad you made it because it is so great. Also got to bring up your fascination with music and movies. I think, you know, Quentin Tarantino and Pulp Fiction really brought out the soundtracks, but you, I think, did it first with all of the movies with American Werewolf in London, Three Amigos, Blues Brothers.
Well, so when you say the soundtracks, do you mean the score or needle drop or what?
I mean, like, actually picking the songs for the film. And
well, sure. In American Werewolf, the songs were in the script. But the first person to really use pop songs mm-hmm. was Mike Nichols in
okay.
The Graduate.
Simon Garfunkel.
Which was basically scored from a Simon and Garfunkel album, mm-hmm. existing album. And then he had them write Mrs. Robinson, you know. But that movie was really the first needle drop movie that used pop songs like that. And there were a lot of movies that had pop songs, but usually as source. But that and then American Graffiti.
Oh, yes.
Which
yes.
brilliantly had Wolfman Jack. So there was, the radios were always on. So there uh-huh. was a... That soundtrack was revolutionary. Something that then greatly influenced Marty Scorsese. If you look at Goodfellas or...
Oh, yes, that whole soundtrack. Or Casino.
Mean Streets or Casino. I mean, those tracks, you know, he's basically using pop songs. And great, brilliantly.
But you did it with...
And you know what else is needle drop? Is 2001.
Yes.
I mean, even though it wasn't intended, it was a... late post-production decision. They did cut it to that as a template, and then they realized we can't improve on this. Was, you know, Strauss Blue Danube with the space station.
Yes.
And the dock. It's just, there still hasn't been anything that good.
And bringing up that, you know, I always think, you know, see you next Wednesday. And that's from Kubrick's 2001, right?
Yeah, it's a line of dialogue from 2000.
But with his daughter talking to him, right?
No. It's when Gary Lockwood's talking to his parents.
That's right. Yes, yes. So see, so you, that's pretty much in all of your movies.
It's not. It's in about half.
Half of them.
Yeah, people always say that it's not an Animal House. Is it Animal House? No, it's not. I wrote a script in like 69, 70, called See You Next Wednesday, which is sort of, it's a fantasy, it's a musical autobiography of me if I died at 19. And it's terrible, but it has really good ideas in it, and it'll never get made, you know. And so, first I referred to it, my first film, Schlock, like this important movie, and then it sort of became very clear that that's never going to get made. So anytime I take a gag or an idea or something from that script, I cannibalize that script all the time. I always give it a credit in the movie.
Yes.
So it's...
And it's great. Did you ever get to meet or talk with Stanley himself?
I met Stanley Kubrick once.
Once? Yeah. Was it at his compound in London, or was it...
No, it was at, I think, Shepherd. I think it was at... It was when I was in pre-production on American Werewolf, and I was at Twickenham, which is a small studio.
Okay.
And in London, and... There are only two studios in London, Twickenham and Ealing.
Okay.
Bill Pinewood, all those are in London, but way far, like an hour and a half drive, you know, really kind of far. These are, you can take a tube to these. And at the top floor of Twickenham, which had like three stages, very small, it's very nice. But the top floor of the, called the director's building, were, it was Dickie Attenborough, or Sir Richard Attenborough, Dick Lester, me, and John Schlesinger. Those were our offices like that. And so Mr. Attenborough, or Sir Dickie, he said, call me Dickie. Richard Attenborough is the only person I ever met who really spoke the way they speak, like Holly, like pussycat, darling.
Okay.
Honey. Sweetheart. He's very British, but he called everyone darling, sweetheart, pussycat. And then you know that movie, What's New, Pussycat?
Yes.
He actually spoke like that. It was wild. Anyway, he was very nice. But anyway, he came around and said, no, I actually think it was Dick Lester who knocked on my door and said, you want to go with us? And they were going to go look at the first demonstration of the Steadicam in the UK.
Awesome.
That Kubrick had flown Garrett Brown over because he was very interested. And so I went with, with John Schlesinger and Richard Lester and Sir Richard Attenborough. In Attenborough, this giant, huge Silver Cloud Rolls Royce that was powder blue with a license that said Dickie. Anyway, darling boy. So we went there, and Garrett Brown gave a demonstration of the Steadicam. And I immediately said, are you going to stay in London? Because I was starting to shoot like in a week or something. And he said, no. And I said, well, how many of them are there? And the thing with Garrett, he trained two British guys to use it. And he had two of them at the time. The first movie to use the Steadicam was Bound for Glory, Hal Ashby, which has a shot that baffled me when I saw the movie. I thought, how the fuck did they do that? Where it's David Carradine as Woody Guthrie is walking towards us, so we're cameras in front like that, and he's pushing through a crowd, thousands of guys, depression. There's a train comes way far away as during the length of this shot, it comes and passes us, and it's going very slowly, like by our left as he's walking, and then sort of at the end of the train, he jumps onto the train, you know, to the ladder on the side of the car. And it's like we sort of stay with him.
Uh-huh.
So from doing this, now we're here on a moving train. And then he climbs up the ladder, and we go up with him, and then he steps onto the roof. And we then go on the roof, and then there's a long scene of him on the roof. And you go, how the fuck did they do? And the way they did it was they had a Chapman crane, and Garrett Brown, the operator, was on a platform, and that's all counterweight, you know. So it was complicated, but it was a long tracking shot. And then when he jumped, the crane just armed up and kept speed. So they did this, and then armed the thing. And then when he stepped onto the, you know, got to the roof, Garrett stepped from the moving platform with all these grips here, to the train, they're all the guys and stuff. And it was an incredible shot. And then, of course, I'm not sure how, so the most, people noticed it in Goodfellas, that incredible shot.
Going through the restaurant.
Copacabana, yeah. Through the kitchen. And what was so interesting was, you know how it ends on Henny Youngman saying, take my wife, please?
Yes.
They did it perfectly three times, and Henny fucked the line. All three times. Like, so the third one worked. But, you know, it took like a whole day.
That's great. And then that's when you met Kubrick?
I met Kubrick at that thing.
Okay.
And he was a real New York guy. I mean, I worship him. You know, I think he's just made extraordinary, unique movies. Dr. Strangelove. He's just amazing. He's just incredible, Kubrick.
Yeah.
Paths of Glory. And I was very much in awe. And he was very Hamish. He was very relaxed, very Jewish, and very New York. He had a New York accent. And he was nice. And I was able to negotiate and get the Steadicam for 2 days.
Awesome.
So in American Werewolf, I think we were the fourth movie to use it or something. And by the way, Kubrick then used it extensively.
In The Shining?
In The Shining, and then later in Full Metal Jacket. But the
in American Werewolf in London?
American Werewolf, we had an English operator, and we did one was a nightmare where it's like the wolf's POV running through the woods, or you don't know who's POV. And then the guy was running full out, which no one ever did with a Steadicam, so he tripped and fell, and I kept it in. If you look at that shot at the end of it, it's just sort of like that. But then we used it in the tube as sort of the wolf's POV when he's chasing. And I never forgot, we were at Technicolor London watching dailies, and Bob Painter, the British GP, Robert Painter, is passed now. Great, wonderful person, great DP. He shot like 10 or 11 movies for me. He shot Thriller, Into the Night, Spies Like Us. What else did Bob shoot? American Werewolf in London. I'm trying to think. I don't even remember. Anyway, Bob, he was great. We're watching the dailies of that Steadicam footage chasing the guy, and he turned to me and he said, "Hey, there's an instant cliche." Because it was so obvious. When we saw it, we went, "Well, we're going to see this shot again and again and again," you know, because it was so clearly designed for it.
Right, yeah, that's awesome. And you've worked with a lot of the greats, and I remember seeing like a Steven Spielberg documentary recently on HBO. They talked about kind of like how you, maybe Zemeckis, Lucas, and Spielberg kind of like...
They didn't mention me.
I thought they did.
Oh, I'd be shocked if they did.
But you kind of, y'all kind of helped each other out during like the 80s or whatever.
Yes, we did, yeah.
Kind of like a club, really.
Not a club. I was friends with Steven and George, and although I had strange experiences with Marty Scorsese and Francis Coppola, both of whom I know now, but the first time I met both of those guys was really in like the 90s or something, and both of them said, "John," and they were so happy to see me, and I was so taken aback by their friendliness, you know, because it was the first time we met, and both of them said, I said, "I don't think we've met." And they both went, "What?" And it was separate, that both Marty and Francis had long, "What are you talking about? We did this and we did that, and I know you." And they had this whole history with me, and I wasn't there. It was so odd. It was like, okay, sure. Anyway, they're both brilliant guys. And, I mean, Steven was very collaborative and protective of Zemeckis. Mm-hmm. And we did all know. And also, I met Steve on the set of Jaws.
Oh, really?
Martha's Vineyard. Michael and Julia Phillips wanted me to write. There was a script called Project Blue Book by Paul Schrader.
Okay.
Which evolved into Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And they wanted me to rewrite it. I was 25. And I flew to Martha's Vineyard, and I arrived the day after Lou Wasserman and Sid Sheinberg had left.
Okay.
And they were told, "You have 3 weeks and you're being shut down." So it was kind of a heavy atmosphere when I got there. They put me in a house with Steven, Ricky Dreyfuss, and Ricky Fields, and Carl Gottlieb, who I just spoke to last week. Carl's wonderful. And he wrote the script, and he's in it, Carl Gottlieb. Anyway, he so I was there waiting to talk to Spielberg but Steve was busy. I mean, it was tense. But after about a week and a half, then we finally spoke.
And
his first words to me were, "You're younger than I am." But that's an extraordinary movie, Jaws.
It is. It's fantastic. I'm glad you got to be a part of that.
If you read, Carl Gottlieb wrote one of the best making of books. I forgot what it's called, but it's The Making of Jaws. And not only is the screenwriter, but as an actor, he was there for everything. And it's really good book about the making of Jaws. And in it, I'm in it only because he mentions I'm there. And what's funny is that he talks about...
Hey, guys, I'm sorry. I got a memory card error.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For the whole thing?
No, just like 10 seconds ago.
Okay.
I think there might be another one in there. Sorry about that.
You know, we're not shooting. He's tiptoeing. He must have just stolen something or broken something to walk like that. But on Jaws, I was going to say, so I was there, and they had, I was bored because they went out in the boat. So I said, what can I do? So there was a guy, I'm trying to, I've forgotten his name, but it's in the book. But it said, help me. So I went and spent a whole day with him, and we built that dock that the shark, remember the fisherman that pulled us the whole
thing? Yes,
yeah,
yes.
I helped build that.
That's all. You're part of Jaws.
So that's my contribution.
That is amazing. That is awesome.
But then right after that, I got offered a really good job. I went, I didn't, Steve was taking, he was so not even thinking about closing
contract, yes.
I mean, you know, or project, that I took the next job I was offered, which was as, I went to London as one of eventually 12 writers on The Spy Who Loved Me, James Bond.
That's really cool, too.
It was you fun. I worked with Tony Burgess, Anthony Burgess.
Oh,
goodbye! He's sneaking around.
That's good. Okay, cool. Cool.
But I was actually, I do have to say that Deborah, my wife and I came into the business at a time when it was dying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was a mailboy at Fox, 66, 67, 68, sort of. And then I worked as a stunt guy. I went to Europe to be a gopher. They're called PAs now. I love that, production assistants. We were called gophers or schleppers.
Fake shemps that Sam Raimi likes.
Yeah,
to
fake shemp. But on a movie called Kelly's Heroes, Clint Eastwood, Don Rickles, Telly Savalas, Don Sutherland, Carol O'Connor, and the Yugoslav Army, you know, as the Nazis and the Americans and the Brits. Big World War II comedy. And so I was in Yugoslavia for a long time, and then 9 months, and then Jim O'Rourke and I drove to Spain. And so we were in Spain for this, really the spaghetti boom. So I got there in like 70, 71. So I was 69, actually. But it was, I was there for over a year and got to work on many movies. I've worked on so many movies. Big and small, and most, not all, but mostly Westerns.
And which is great, because we've talked about Westerns earlier, and that's great that you have worked and you're so passionate about.
They're just the most fun. You know, yeah. I learned, actually, I got pretty good. I would never even attempt it now, but I got pretty good at you falling off horses getting shot. Yeah.
That's pretty great. Like, so did you get to, like, direct the stuntman in your own movies? Like, this is how you fall. This is how you run.
Well, I wouldn't presume to. No, the stunt people are responsible. You have a stunt coordinator and they're responsible. And also, it's interesting how things have changed in terms of stunts, because, like, in the Blues Brothers, you look at that. Well, that's real.
Yeah. Those
and you spend a great deal of time hiding wires and cables and things, and you have to light and hide. Yeah. Now, you can do anything, and because you can just erase all the safety harnesses.
Yeah.
And just erase things. So it's much simpler. And safer to shoot stunts now. Also, the stuntmen have changed. Stuntmen, traditional Hollywood stuntmen, all came from rodeo. So they were like, balls out, Hal Needham, yee-haw, you know, Yakima Canutt. They were all cowboys and could really take physical punishment, you know, right. And bull riders and stuff. And now almost all the stunt coordinators come out of martial arts or dance, and it's very different.
It's interesting how that's changed over time.
Yeah.
I have two more quick questions. One, my first one is, I know your son is really into pro wrestling. I wonder if you were the conduit for him to get into pro wrestling.
As a kid, I remember Haystack Calhoun and Gorgeous George and
Gorgeous
stuff,
George.
But I was never really into, I always knew it was fake.
Right, right.
And my son, as a little kid, got into wrestling long before it was hip to get into it. And my friend Andy Kaufman was fascinated by wrestling. I had several meals with Freddie Blassie and Andy, which were pretty memorable. But and Bob Smuda, those guys. But the wrestling, Max really got into it on the narrative side, you know, because it's really like kabuki. If you watch especially the WWE, it's become so stylized that it's about mostly entrances and exits.
Yep.
And, you know, they have all these storylines. They're called face and, you know, the good guy, the bad guy. There's actually a very interesting and good, because it's about a wrestler, there's a tremendous insight into wrestling on HBO right now.
Andre the Giant.
Have you seen it?
I absolutely
have. It's really good.
It is great.
And you see a lot of how it was territorial. And
then, yep. You know. Oh, it's great. And my last question, since you're so passionate about film. Oh, sorry.
What I started to say was that Max, when he was a kid, I remember when he was like 9 and 10, I took him several times to the sports arena, wherever the wrestlers were. We went to see the wrestlers, the show, because it was really like circus. And he really enjoyed it. And he actually, when he went to school in Miami, he started, a lot of them live in Florida. And he actually started relationships with Dave Foley and all these Goldberg, all these wrestlers as his kid. And he made a film.
Yeah, it was a documentary. I'm like, this is still real.
It's called Wrestling Isn't Wrestling.
Yeah, yeah.
Years ago, God, that's years ago, that got millions of hits on YouTube, and all of the wrestlers loved it.
Yes.
So he became, Vince McMahon wanted to hire him. He worked for them for a while. But he was really into it in a way that I never really. I'm impressed by the physical skills of wrestlers. I mean, good wrestlers really do work so hard. And it's hard to sell a gag, you know, when they do all these body slams or things. The guy who's doling out the punishment is the guy responsible for protecting the other player. You know, you really, they work it out. And there's all these, it's like kabuki. It's so ritualized and stylized.
Yeah, no, I love it.
Max is really into it. And Wrestling Isn't Wrestling is fascinating because, what's that character? He's married to Stephanie McMahon.
Triple H.
Yeah. He does this like faux biography of Triple H that Triple H loved.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Wrestling Isn't Wrestling, and I think what the wrestlers responded to, is the fact that he makes this passionate argument for wrestling as art.
It is.
And he's very sincere.
It is. It's a great doc. I love it.
Did you ever, well, there's a wonderful doc called Beyond the Mat.
Yes, and that was with Ron Howard Studios or something.
They had nothing to do with it, but they did. That was paid for and made as a passion project by Barry Blaustein.
Yes, yes.
Who was one of the writers of Coming to America.
Awesome.
And he worked with Eddie on Saturday Night Live, David Sheffield and Barry. But what's fascinating about Beyond the Mat is it gets in a little more of the politics in terms of wrestling's basically a monopoly now by Vince McMahon.
Yes.
And it's, they're not treated very well or paid very well for what they do.
Yeah, they're paid, but they have to pay like their own lodging and travel.
They are not well treated. And it's fascinating how people like Dick Batista and The Rock, certain people have crossed over.
Yes.
Into mainstream movie stardom, which is fascinating.
It is. It's fun to see how it's progressed from, you know, the early 80s or 70s to now.
Well, one of the things about Beyond the Mat that's fun is that's when when The Rock was a villain.
Yeah, and a lot of people know that Rock was the villain, and that shows that match, that pay-per-view of him hitting Foley in the head 16 times with a chair and then passing out in his... the famous shot of his daughters watching it crying.
Yeah.
It's real. So, yeah, I remember that. It's a powerful scene. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, no, Max is ahead of the curve, really.
All right, my last question is,
yes.
I know you're passionate about films. What are some of your favorite, like a couple of your favorite scenes from movies that have always stuck with you that you just love?
Hundreds of scenes. There's so many movies. That's why I won't participate. It's very hard when they say, name the 5 best movies or the 10. There's these 10 best lists. What a horseshit thing. I mean, because you get movies like, let's name some great movies. His Girl Friday,
mm-hmm.
Howard Hawks. Ben Heck, Charles MacArthur, movie, right? Rosalind Russell, Cary Grant. It's perfect. It's a brilliant film. So can I compare that to Goodfellas? Can I say...
For certain scenes, it's always like a certain scene that like just stuck with you. Like something like, you know, like the barbershop scene from Coming to America, or, you know, Spud going in for a job interview and train spotting and just completely, you know, fucking it up.
Well, there are hundreds of scenes. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, you name the talent because, what am I, I mean, Laurel and Hardy, there's so many scenes.
Right.
In Way Out West, there's a moment where Jimmy Finlayson, do you know, he was the Scottish guy, sort of balding, with a great walrus mustache. He's the one who go, close one eye. But he plays the villain, Mickey Finn, as the saloon keeper. He's really a bad guy. It's a Western. And Laurel and Hardy come in with the deed for the daughter of someone whose works is like a slave girl in the kitchen. And there's this wonderful scene where Stan and Ollie just, like angels, they're so innocent. They come to the bar, and they say, does whatever her name is work here? And, you know, the tough whore, who's a woman, I can't think of her name, but she's great. The movie is wonderful. She says, why? What's it to you? And then, well, we have this deed for the gold mine, you know. And Mickey Finn, you know, what? So he's right there, and he says, I'm her guardian, you know. And there's a scene where he talks them out of giving the deed to the girl and give it to him for the girl. And there's this moment, it's Leo McCary, but there's, well, I'm not sure who's right, but there's this moment where his villainy is so outrageous that Jimmy Finlayson turns to the camera like, can you believe how evil I am? It's just, he can't get over his own badness. It's just a wonderful moment. And W.C. Fields, you think of moments like in It's a Gift. It's a Gift is probably a perfect movie. Mm-hmm. I think it's genius. And it has long sequences, the Carl LaFong sequence. And this, it's a brilliant movie, but it has the best ending. I kind of stole the ending from Trading Places. But there's there's this, he's a storekeeper, and he goes into the store, and it's a big barrel of molasses. And the cork has been pulled out, and the molasses is just pouring out of it all over the floor of the store. And baby Leroy, who's literally a baby, he's 2 years old, he's holding the cork. And, oh, what's his name? Grady Sutton is his, like, the storekeep. And Fields comes in and just looks like, what? Grady Sutton, it's just this wonderful shot where it's like the baby and Grady and the molasses pouring. And Grady Sutton goes, I told him I wouldn't do it if I was him. You know, just, I mean, there's so many moments. In His Girl Friday, this movie is Cary Grant, who was a genius at farce and very physical with words and his face. I mean, he's just great. Rosalind Russell at her peak. Genius dialogue, beautifully staged, and the movie's going a mile a minute. It's fabulous. And then about halfway through, Billy Gilbert comes in, and he comes with the pardon from the governor. And the mayor and the sheriff don't want, they want the hanging to go through. So they lie to him and get rid of him. And he's just so brilliant. He's so incredible that he steals the whole movie. You know, he's got two scenes. And when he comes back at the opportune time, he's just so brilliant. He's so funny. And when the mayor is lying, and he's like, oh, he just can't, he can't believe it. There's so many, yeah, Preston Sturges movies. There are so many genius moments with Eddie Bracken.
We'll have to do another.
Or, you know, in the there's so many movies. You know, in the Magnificent Seven, when one of the banditos is running away and Yul Brynner chases after him, and the bandito really far away on a horse, just a silhouette, and he's like, "Is it James Cole?" No, I think it's Yul Brynner, but Horse Buckholz is the kid. Watching, and Yul Brynner goes like this, and shoot! And then you see the little figure fall off the horse. Dead. course, Buckholz blown away. He says, "That's the greatest shot I've ever seen." And as he walks out of the shot, putting his gun away, Yul Brynner says, "I was aiming for the horse." But there's so many brilliant. Have you ever seen The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
Oh, yes.
Now, that's a movie that's supposed to be starring Clint Eastwood. And it's clear that Sergio Leone fell in love with Eli Wallach.
Yes.
And it becomes Eli Wallach's movie. The Ugly, it should be called The Ugly, the Bad, and the Good. You know? And it's just, it's so funny. He's so brilliant that Eli Wallach, you knew the director was so happy. And there's whole scenes that you know Eli Wallach just made up.
That is good.
You know, when he takes the gun up, what is that? You know? So it's, you know, there's so many, hundreds and hundreds.
I'm glad you're giving them to me. That's great. But thank you so much for doing this interview. I'm very excited.
Okay,
and
thank
you. Big fan. And thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Okay, thank you. I know I'm leaving out. You know the scariest thing I ever saw in a movie?
Was it the crucifix scene in Exorcist?
No, that wasn't scary. That was just shocking.
Okay.
No, the scariest thing I've ever seen in a movie is when I saw 2001 the first time. And we saw it before we knew anything about it. I went to school with Louis Blau's son. Louis Blau was Kubrick's lawyer. And so he was Louis Blau was going to see the movie. So we're at the Pacific Stanley Warner Theater in the first row of the balcony, Cinerama. And we knew nothing. We just knew Kubrick. And saw 2001. And that moment when Hal has murdered Gary Lockwood and Peter Lake tries to save him. Forget it, he's dead. And often, and he comes back to this Jupiter spaceship, and here's the pod. He says, "Open the pod bay doors, Hal." Hal, open the pod bay doors, Hal. And you cut to this shot of the pod and the Jupiter one in deep space, and you think, holy fuck.
Yeah.
Hal, and then you hear, "I'm afraid I can't do that, Dave." I just went, ah!
That just makes my hair stand.
Yeah, it was so scary.
It just had like the whole lip reading thing. Oh, that was so good. Oh.
Well, that voice of Hal.
Yes.
And you know, it was Marty Balsam.
It was?
Yeah.
That's
replaced
great.
It. Now where do I go? Oh, I'm here? Here we are with our Fiji water.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And I've got to say, one of my other favorite scenes in the movie was in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles at the car rental place with Steve Martin losing his mind.
Well, that's like Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces. Remember when he tried to order it?
The bacon.
Yeah,
which I think Nick Cage did in Matchstick Men in the pharmacy.
There are hundreds.
Yeah. We'll have to talk later about all of them. Do a whole thing.
I love it, Psycho. Mother's not herself today.
It is.